Hello, welcome to Radio Reading Services, weekly edition of the Northwest Press and the Western Hills Press. I'm Joe Bickers. We'll start off this week with the Northwest Press. Our first story, 12 years after Boy Scout robbery, an unlikely friendship develops. When John Hancock Jr. met recently with Kenneth Hodge, the man who punched him in the face during a robbery 12 years ago, they embraced. They talked about their jobs. Hancock, 24, works third shift at a substance abuse facility. The 30-year-old Hodge, who has been out of prison less than a week, said he'd landed a temp job cleaning Great American Ballpark. It was an unlikely reunion. They talked about going to the Bengals game together. The last time they were this close to each other was December 3, 2007. Hodge, then 18, and two others robbed Hancock, another boy, and their fathers as they were selling Christmas trees in a North College Hill parking lot to raise money for their Boy Scout troop. Hancock was 13 years old. The other boy was 10. Hancock recalls one of the robbers, he later learned it was Hodge, punching him in the left side of his face. "I go down, and the next thing I know, I see a sawed-off shotgun," Hancock said. One of the other robbers had the shotgun. The incident left Hancock shaken and angry. He wanted the death penalty for the three robbers. A lot happened between that day and now. There was forgiveness, intervention by the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, and the evolution of Hodge from an anger-filled, wayward teenager to a man with a new mindset. At age 18, Hodge said he valued the approval of his friends above everything else. His mindset, at the time, he wrote in a letter to Hancock, was that of a sad boy who did not know how to be a man, the reason being I was not around any men, only boys. Boy Scout robbery. In an interview, Hodge said there was no true decision made to commit a robbery. They were bored. They had free time. It just kind of happened, he said. When they saw the tree sale in the parking lot, Hodge said, they didn't know they were robbing Boy Scouts. The case drew national attention because of the circumstances. Boy Scouts and Christmas trees. Court documents say the robbers got away with $130, but prosecutors sought lengthy sentences for Hodge and his two co-defendants. In sentencing Hodge to 18 years in prison and his co-defendants, who had prior felony records, to 19 years, Hamilton County Common Pleas Judge David Davis called it a very heinous crime. How could you even think about robbing a bunch of Boy Scouts selling Christmas trees, Davis asked, according to Enquirer archives. For several years, Hancock harbored hatred towards Hodge and the others. But when he was about 17, his outlook changed. He had gone through family and personal upheaval and eventually came out of it wanting to find a way to peace and joy. He credits faith. I was asking myself, do I forgive them? Hancock said. I forgave them, and then it was, just like that, over. Meanwhile, Hodge was going through his own personal transformation in prison. His thinking evolved, he said. Among the most important changes was coming to the realization that being in prison is not a normal life, he said. Excuse me. Once I did that, I think I succeeded, he said. I understood where I was, and I understood where I needed to develop. Hodge learned job skills like plumbing and carpentry. He put his mind to work. He earned his GED. He completed classes on victim awareness and anger management. He developed a work ethic that he said had been dormant. I developed the tools to get what I want, he said. I had to understand what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. And I can't be that type of person who takes what you have just because I don't have it. He also gained new values, no longer seeking the approval of his friends over everything else. The things that I valued before that day, the day I robbed those people, changed, he said. Once I did that, my prior issues went out the window. An unlikely friendship. By 2016, Hodge had been in prison for 8 years. His attorneys had earlier appealed his sentence to the Ohio Supreme Court, challenging how Hodge's sentence was structured. Hodge's 18-year prison term is made up of six separate 3-year sentences. He was convicted of a gun charge and 5 counts of aggravated robbery, 1 count for the 2 boys and their fathers, and another count for the Boy Scouts of America. The court's ruling wasn't entirely favorable, but in 2011, the state legislature, citing the Supreme Court case bearing Hodge's name in State v. Hodge, brought back some limits on consecutive sentences, which the state had used before Hodge was sentenced. But the law was not applied retroactively, meaning it didn't impact him. Attorney Stephen Johnson Grove, who was at the time was the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, decided to pursue a judicial release for Hodge. He became eligible last year after serving 10.5 years, but a judge would have to make the decision partly based on whether the victim supported it. Johnson Grove tried to contact the 4 victims and heard back from 2, including Hancock Jr., who said he was incredibly receptive. Johnson Grove encouraged Hodge to write Hancock. Hodge said writing the letters with sincerity was easy because of the changes he'd made within himself. In the first letter, sent in August 2016, Hodge wrote, "I know saying sorry may or may not change things, but I want you and your family to know that I am very sorry, and that the things I have done were, are, still wrong. And I know I have hurt you and your family in ways I might not ever know." That letter led to about 20 they exchanged, Hancock estimated. In one, Hancock, who led a church ministry for young adults, thanked Hodge for his apology and let him know he forgave Hodge and the others. "I want to be friends with you, as weird as that may sound," he said. Hancock also didn't know it was Hodge who had punched him until Hodge told him in a letter. "I can laugh at it now," Hancock wrote. "You had a good throw because I had pain in my jaw for almost 3 days and a bruise for almost 2 weeks. I haven't been hit in a lot in my life, but I can tell that was a good punch." A free man. Hancock was able to convince his father to support Hodge's early release, and eventually all 4 victims supported it. The Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office ultimately decided not to oppose releasing him. At a September 19th hearing, Common Pleas Judge Patrick Foley III ordered Hodge's prison sentence to be suspended, and he was let out of jail that day. Hodge had spent the previous 4,292 days incarcerated. By 2:30 in the afternoon, he was outside. "Felt the sun on my skin as a free man," he said. "I couldn't beat that." David Singleton, who heads the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, said Hodge's case fits with the organization's goal of reducing mass incarceration. Part of that involves finding prisoners who don't present a danger to society, have served a significant portion of their sentence, and can demonstrate they have been rehabilitated. He calls the project Beyond Guilt. Singleton said too many people, like Hodge, are locked up too long for offenses that don't warrant it. "That's an injustice that we need to fix," he said. Continuing to read from the Northwest Press, our next story, "Is This the End of Colerain Football? Northwest schools say levy passage needed to keep programs running." Northwest local schools say if a school levy on the November ballot doesn't pass, all sports and music extracurriculars will be cut in the district, including Colerain High School football. The Northwest High School Knights would also see their stadium go dark. It's more than sports and music, though. The cuts will include teachers, meaning class sizes will get bigger. Transportation is not on the table now, but officials said moving back to the 2-mile state-mandated transportation limit could be on the table if the district doesn't pass a levy. The cuts approved by the Board of Education, if the November 5th levy fails, total $9.1 million. The plan for reductions, if the levy fails, includes a reduction of at least 20 administrative positions, a reduction of 24 middle and high school teachers, a reduction of 20 elementary school teachers, a reduction of nurses, librarians, assistants, and school resource officers, elimination of all sports and music extracurriculars at middle schools and high schools, art, PE, music, gifted classes, and advanced placement class could also be eliminated. If it passes, the 7.5 mil levy will cost the owner of a $100,000 home an additional $262.56 a year, or about $22 a month. District officials have said a levy failure would be catastrophic because the district would face an $8.5 million deficit. All sports would be eliminated. No exceptions will be made, district officials say. This is a new levy which will run side by side with an existing operating levy. The district has not raised taxes since 2007. The existing levy, last renewed in 2017 by more than 75% of voters, is for 5.04 mils. Renewal levies have a set dollar amount, and that amount never changes. The amount of funds received in 2012 and in 2017 were based on the 2007 amount. So if the new levy passes, the owner of a $100,000 home will be paying a total of $411 a year in property taxes for the school district. Other than the cuts, officials do have a backup plan if the levy fails. Ask for an even bigger levy in March. If the November levy fails, officials say no cuts will be made immediately. The cuts will happen in August 2020 after the backstop levy campaign, which could make many cuts unnecessary if it passes. The Corrine High School football team has gone undefeated in six seasons since 1994 and won a state championship in 2004. The team hasn't had a losing season in 28 years. The team has a 4-1 record so far this school year. The Northwest Knights, whose boosters helped rehab the castle, the high school stadium, in 2016, had its last winning season that year. Our next story from the Northwest Press. Green Township Hotel is getting closer to being a done deal. Green Township officials are working with a development group that wants to bring a 94-room hotel to the community. Hamilton County Rural Zoning Commission staff recommended approval of a zone change on about 4 acres at 6336 Harrison Avenue from residential to planned retail at the commission's September 16th meeting. Brandy Corp, a development company based in Bellevue, Kentucky, is spearheading the zone change for the property. The plan also includes a 6,200-square-foot, one-story commercial building. Township officials said the hotel would develop under Sean Pan, president of NKY Hospitality, LLC, Hampton Inn & Suites, Newport, Kentucky. Brandicorp would develop the remaining commercial building. There were a number of conditions, including limiting signs, screening mechanical equipment and dumpsters, and connecting the building to proposed sidewalks. Green Township Administrator Frank Birkenhauer isn't ready to celebrate just yet. As he said, the proposed zone change still must go before the Hamilton County Commissioners, likely in October. In addition, there are other site due diligence issues that must be wrapped up before the project can move forward, he said. Birkenhauer said the township has had high hopes before on development projects, only to have the deals unravel before they can get signed. But he's hopeful the township is about to get a second hotel. If it does, it's good for the community, according to Green Township trustee Tony Roziola. He said finding the right location was a challenge for developers, but the location they selected is centrally located and near the township's other hotel, the Holiday Inn Express, on Ribault Road. He said the hotel can help residents house out-of-town guests for holidays, serve medical and corporate visitors, as well as host people in town for weddings and other events. Another advantage Green Township provides is the close proximity to downtown Cincinnati, he said. Roziola said the hotel could also generate restaurants and retail development along the Harrison Road corridor. Our last story today from the Northwest Press. Corrine trustee candidate accused of choking woman. A man running from Corrine Township trustee had been accused of throwing a woman from a moving car and choking her until she passed out, according to a police report. Corrine Township police arrested Kylan Peck, age 27, Friday morning. He's charged with two counts of domestic violence after an incident that began driving home from Kenny's Sports Bar. The Enquirer does not identify victims of domestic violence. The report says Peck was driving home with his girlfriend at 1:48 a.m. when the two began to argue about politics. The woman said Peck hit her in the face twice in the car. She told police that when they arrived home, Peck removed her from the car by her neck and she lost consciousness. When she regained consciousness, she said, she tried to call police, at which time she said Peck took her phone and Apple Watch and threw the phone into the woods. According to the report, she went inside and asked her son to call the police. She said Peck took her son's phone as well. The youngster reported his phone and iPad were taken, and he was choked. The woman was eventually able to get the attention of a neighbor who called the police. The report says Peck fled to a family member's home where he was arrested. Peck is on the ballot against Todd Allen, Matt Wallert, and Joseph Walterman in this November's election for trustee. There is one open seat on the board. This is Peck's first time running for office. Peck was being held at the Hamilton County Justice Center at the time this article was originally published. He was scheduled to be arraigned Saturday morning in Hamilton County Municipal Court. And now we'll switch over to the Western Hills Press. Our first story, First Look. See inside of the FC Cincinnati Stadium. Suites on sale. FC Cincinnati Stadium is rising from the ground and more than a year away from its scheduled March 2021 opening, but the team is already selling suites. Pictures provided to the Enquirer show open and airy suites with luxurious fixtures with a clean and contemporary feel. They offer a communal experience with a large island for gathering, a full-size refrigerator, and wine coolers. They're closer to the field than is typical, 32 feet from the action. The lower level of the suites at the new stadium are equal to standing at the rail or concourse at Nippert Stadium. The $250 million privately funded stadium will have 54 suites. The team is asking suite owners for a $10,000 refundable deposit, which would allow clients to reserve their suites in the new stadium later this year. But officials won't say just how much the suites will cost overall. We're excited to finally introduce Cincinnati to the first of the premium seats in our West End Stadium, FC Cincinnati President Jeff Birding told the Enquirer. As with every aspect of this facility, we've put intense thought and perspective into the stadium's design to provide all of our fans a best in-class customer experience in Cincinnati. West End Stadium Suite Details. The 54 suites are located on two dedicated suite levels on the west side of the stadium. Each suite has 22 seats, 18 outdoor, 4 indoor, as well as private entertainment space and access to other social areas in the stadium. Suite seating will be the closest and most intimate suite experience in Cincinnati. Suite seating at West End Stadium will be closer to the field than at Nippert Stadium. New way to buy premium seats. Fans will use a virtual stadium simulator that gives every person the exact view from the seats. A 5,000 square foot immersion area at the team's downtown corporate offices at 14 East 4th Street will allow all season ticket holders and potential season ticket members to gain a greater understanding of game day experience. It has renderings of the stadium's design and layout, a scaled model of the stadium, examples of all seats in the stadium, and general stadium information. Continuing to read from the Western Hills Press, our next story. Representative Bill Blessing picked to replace Senator Lou Turhar. Republicans in the Ohio Senate selected Representative Bill Blessing to replace resigning Senator Lou Turhar. Blessing, Republican from Colerain Township, has served in the Ohio House of Representatives since 2013. He filled the seat held by his father, Lou Blessing. The younger Blessing faces term limits in 2020. He was chosen over former Representative Jonathan Deaver, Republican from Madeira, and former municipal clerk of Judith Boyce of Cleves. Turhar, from Green Township, is stepping down on the advice of doctors. He won the Senate seat in 2016 after serving 6 years in the Ohio House of Representatives. The district includes western and parts of northern Hamilton County. And in a related FC Cincinnati story, county breaks promise to fund garage. Hamilton County Commissioners and FC Cincinnati remain at odds over how much money the county should contribute to build a 1,000-space garage for FC Cincinnati's new soccer stadium. A document exchanged between both parties, recently obtained by the Inquirer, shows the county has offered to put $3 million of cash into the project, then borrow the rest of the money. But if after 7 years, the garage isn't self-sustaining, the team would be required to cover the debt payments. In the document, the team says that's not good enough. The county voted to build the garage, which it estimated to cost $25 million. A team attorney said FC Cincinnati should not have to incur the risk of covering debt payments because that means the county isn't paying for the garage as it previously promised. The team countered the county's offer with a request that the county put down $15 million, the document shows. That's where the talks seem to have stalled. If the two sides cannot come to an agreement, it would set up a potential legal fight over the garage's financing and likely would mean the garage may not open when the stadium does in March 2021, no matter who pays for it. The team says a garage is crucial to being a good neighbor in the West End, where residents are concerned about fans taking parking spaces where residents normally park. City Council passed a residential parking plan for the neighborhood last month. The county has voted three times, most recently in May 2018, to build a 1,000-space garage for the team. In addition to the differences over the amount of cash being put down by the county, the document shows the county is asking that the team provide a pad-ready site for the garage, seek a state grant for the project. The county proposal, seen by the Inquirer, calls for FC Cincinnati to pay for operating the garage, but to only receive parking revenue on game days. FC Cincinnati would get development and air rights, but would pay for anything built in those spaces, a provision both sides agree on. The county would be responsible for capital repairs. The team plans to build a garage on the stadium site, though it hasn't said where. At one point, the team hoped the county would build two 500-square-space garages. The county suggested one could be at Findlay Market, where parking is desperately needed. But the team said that's not close enough to count as a garage in close proximity to the stadium, as the agreement calls for. FC Cincinnati President Jeff Birding could not be reached for comment. Brock Denton, General Counsel of FC Cincinnati, said, "What has been offered to date has been far short of the county's voted commitment. Negotiations have gone on for 18 months, he said. This garage was a key county commitment not only to FCC, but also to the city of Cincinnati as a key investment to alleviate growing parking challenges in the neighborhoods, Denton said. We have had ongoing concerns, and what has been offered to date has been far short of the county's voted commitment. The team, Denton said, relied on the promised garage as part of the stadium plan. The team had been repeatedly told that the county would use surplus parking revenues from the banks to finance this garage, Denton said. It has been difficult to get the county to focus on honoring their commitment to both fund and build this garage. We've been told there's a belief that the county can back out of its commitment to fund and build the garage if FCC is unwilling to accept terms that were never contemplated at the time the county made its commitment. This has made it very difficult to reach definitive terms. Commissioner Janice Driehaus says she was not familiar with the $3 million offer, saying County Administrator Jeff Aliuto has been the lead negotiator, but she said negotiations are ongoing. Driehaus said she wanted to debunk a rumor that the FC Cincinnati garage is being held up because there's no deal to build a music venue at the banks, which sets up a domino-like deal where parts of the development would be paid for out of stadium sales tax revenue. One does not have to do with the other, Driehaus said. The FCC garage down payment would come from parking revenue from current parking operations. We are continuing to try and negotiate with the FC Cincinnati to build a garage for fans with a community benefit. So that's what we're working on, Driehaus said. Aluoto said the county only recently received commercial development projections for the project, which will be used to model the garage's financial performance. The county's position is firmly rooted in the board's 2018 resolution, Aluoto said. The facility needs to be financially viable while also supporting the needs of both the team and the community. We continue to partner with the team on approaches toward meeting all of these goals. FC Cincinnati is building a privately funded $250 million stadium, which was key to Cincinnati being awarded a Major League Soccer franchise beginning in 2019. City taxpayers are covering $35 million in infrastructure costs. Cincinnati City Council approved that amount, partly based on the county's votes to pay for the parking garage. But for the garage to be built in time, traffic pattern planning should already have started, with construction beginning by mid-February, the document says. The county has hired Walker Consulting to study the parking issue. Driehaus previously told the Inquirer the county would still build the parking spaces, but that it would be in a place where it's used for the broader community. And our last story today, ProScan defends itself against fraud allegations. Pushing back against a federal whistleblower lawsuit accusing ProScan Imaging of fraud, the founder of the radiology practice has written to dozens of doctors who have referred patients to ProScan that the allegations are not true. "You have been working closely with our physicians and our team of support staff long enough to know our quality, our service attitude, and our ethics," said the letter from Dr. Stephen J. Pomeranz, ProScan's chief executive officer and medical director. "While the events of the past several days have been frustrating, we want you to know that nothing has changed." Pomeranz sent the letter after a federal judge in Cincinnati unsealed the lawsuit accusing ProScan of defrauding Medicare, Medicaid, and the veterans health insurer TRICARE of hundreds of thousands of dollars. The lawsuit said ProScan recruited unqualified people to read pictures taken of patients by magnetic resonance imaging machines that ProScan owns. The suit claims ProScan billed the government as if radiologists had analyzed the films. ProScan operates 25 imaging centers in 7 states, including Ohio and Kentucky. ProScan also runs a practice where radiologists read MRI imaging and write reports for doctors who have sent patients to ProScan for testing. The suit was filed by Dr. Peter Rothschild, a Louisville radiologist, and Jason Taylor, a radiologic technician in Louisville. The lawsuit claims that ProScan uses ghost readers to dodge government requirements that medical doctors sign off on MRI reports, eliminating significant overhead costs associated with following the rules. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. I'm Joe Bickers, wishing everyone a wonderful week.